Harley, we're back in Las Vegas at Equity Derivatives Conference, EQD. We've been here any number of times. We get the opportunity to do some of our, I guess we would call it, keeping it simple on the road sort of events here. And we're sitting down with Roni Israelov at Endeavor. NDVR is actually how it's spelled. Roni, you and I have known each other for many years. You were at AQR, one of the smartest guys I knew at AQR, significantly smarter than the other bald guy at AQR.
Go there.
Yeah, I'm going to leave it alone. But the tell us a little bit about Endeavor, because you guys soft launched last year, and apparently you just officially launched this month.
You're right. So so we are a direct-to-consumer registered investment advisor. We call what we do wealth optimization. So it's the next generation of wealth management. And our clients have the ability to interact with our advisors. We have advisors in-house that perform financial planning services. And then we create plan-optimized portfolios. So we build hyper-personalized portfolios that are multi-asset class and include stocks, bonds, futures, derivatives when appropriate, in order to help satisfy our clients' goals.
And so you would be, for example, an end user of, your advisors could be end users of Simplify products, for example, not to force you in that direction, but just to highlight the products that you guys would be using.
Yeah, so we enable a number of different types of asset classes, including ETFs. So it's possible. We do try to in-house as much as the asset management as we can. Building custom portfolios is an important part of how we operate. So when I talk about the fact that we build multi-asset class portfolios, there's a stock component to that, in which case we have what we call Endeavor Personalized Indexing. So we build a portfolio of 150 to 250 stocks that can have factor exposures, tax loss harvesting, socially responsible investing, really customized for the for each individual client's goals. But then that is diversified against a bond portfolio, which can have a growth tilt towards it. So, and we offer bonds at different maturities depending on the risk profile of the client. We also include liability-driven investing in what we do. So when we think about financial planning for clients, you know, they can have long-term retirement goals or goals to fund the education, you know, of their kids. And in the institutional world, you know, the common way to de-risk or mitigate the risk of that is immunization strategies, right? So liability-driven investing, building a custom bond portfolio that is duration matched against those cash flows. So we've built in-house the capabilities to do that. So we build custom portfolios of treasury bonds that are duration matched against the plan. And then essentially we combine a growth portfolio with those custom bond portfolios to find the risk, the right portfolio at the right risk profile for a client, taking into account kind of their risk sensitivity to cash flows in conjunction with their risk sensitivity to drawdowns, and also in conjunction with our growth goals.
And so this is, I mean, the way I think about this is that this is kind of the next generation of technology-enabled wealth management services, right?
And absolutely.
One of the things you highlight is that you're doing a lot of stuff in-house, a lot of capabilities. You mentioned equities. I know that you guys directly manage equities through factor exposures in various ways. And part of what we're here to talk about is some of the work that you've done on the diversification aspects of equity portfolios.
Yeah.
When you talk about bonds, are you also doing active management of the bond portfolios where you're actively selecting CUSIPs, or are you managing that primarily through other ETFs or mutual funds, et cetera?
Yes, on the bond side, we focus primarily on treasuries. So it's either treasury bonds, notes, or bills, you know, depending on the context. We also include something that's akin to a synthetic corporate bond. So I've done research looking into the properties of corporate bonds and relating them to factor exposures that they have. And, you know, as you know, a corporate bond is like a government bond plus a short put option, you know, according to Merton. And given that profile, a corporate bond has long equity exposure and short volatility exposure. So you can synthesize a corporate bond using derivatives, and we offer, you know, that strategy as well. We do not invest in corporate bonds themselves, and mostly because we believe that the synthetic, you know, approach has better expected performance and better expected risk profile.
It has much less idiosyncratic component to it, right? And so this is something I talk about all the time in bond portfolios. If you're going to be a Canyon Partners, where I came out of, for example, and you're going to know credit really, really well, like, that's fantastic. But if you're going to manage a credit portfolio on a quant basis, manage a quant portfolio, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about credit is if you look at it passively, and that's what I really focused on in my research, I looked at passive credit exposure, the alpha to all of the underlying risk factors that it has is negative. So it's hard for me to kind of look at those results and justify an allocation to passive credit. And, you know, it has higher trading costs. And some of that is assisted by, you know, allocating to potentially corporate bonds in an ETF or mutual fund wrapper. But if I think about passive credit, it's hard to get excited about that. I think there could be something interesting in active credit. You know, I think there are opportunities potentially to for portfolio managers to add alpha in an active exposure. At the same time, I would say it's worth keeping in mind that I think they face a headwind, you know, given just the underlying average alpha of corporate bonds. So essentially, we've chosen not to participate in that specific asset class for the reasons that I just enumerated. The other thing I would say is in taxable accounts, I think corporate bonds are pretty tax inefficient because the coupon is taxed as ordinary income. It's taxed both at the local level and at the federal level because there are defaults and downgrades. You expect to see, you know, potentially some capital loss offsetting some of the heightened coupon, but those are taxed in different ways, right? So the coupon gets ordinary tax treatment. The potential capital losses that offset it might be long-term capital loss. So I also think corporate bonds are not tax efficient instruments.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, through a lot of our strategies, we're doing the same thing where we effectively are using synthetics to gain exposure to bonds for tax efficiency reasons, among others, right? A total return swap is actually quite a bit more tax efficient for a retail investor if you can capture it through an ETF than it is if you do a, you know, outright capital risk versus the ordinary income on the coupons, exactly as you're highlighting.
Right, and we look at futures contracts as well, which have the 1256 tax treatment. Yep. So it's 60% long-term capital gains, 40% short-term capital gains, and very liquid. I mean, the other potential challenge with corporate bonds is in times of stress, investment grade can become quite illiquid, and you can see, you know, mini crashes, if you will, and you've seen less of that.
Yeah, in the futures contract.
Exactly.
Yeah. The relative performance between these various assets, how much is the tax treatment more or less important than the trading or allocation? Is it significant enough to make a difference?
I think they all play a role. I mean, it's not all about taxes. So I think it still makes sense in a retirement account to take the synthetic approach, even though there you don't have the tax advantage. But I think there are just a number of benefits to going to the underlying exposure. I mean, the other benefit, which we haven't talked about, is you have a lot more control. You know, you buy corporate bonds, and the credit rating is going to change. The credit risk is going to change. The spread is going to change. Oftentimes, if you're interested in a very specific maturity, the universe of bonds available can be small. So you're taking considerable concentration risk if you care about a maturity. If you think about the underlying exposures instead, you can control it much more directly. If you want 30-year bond exposure, you buy 30-year treasuries or 30-year bond futures, and you can couple that with either a little bit of synthetic credit risk and have an investment grade type of portfolio. You can heighten that if you want to have a high yield.
And so would you obtain the IG exposure by effectively selling a put on the S&P, for example? Would that be an easy way to do it, or on the Russell?
Selling a put is one way to go. Yeah. Another way to go is VIX futures. So I think we've found VIX futures to be just more operationally convenient. But I think both are plausible, you know, approaches. Because, you know, if you sell the VIX future, that gives you equity beta and the vol premium combined. And you get pretty close to the exposure that you get in the synthetic. And I don't think it's really important to perfectly try to match the corporate bond. You know, the idea is the corporate bond is giving you exposure to vol, it's giving you exposure to equity, it's giving you exposure to bond itself. So it's not so important to say, let me precisely match the exposure of that. I mean, if you're running an institutional account and you're benchmarked against IG and people are considering the tracking error to IG, then you have to be very close. But if the goal is to provide risk premia in a portfolio, then we can really think about how to size the individual risk premia appropriately, you know, across in consideration of the entire asset allocation.
I know we're going to talk about indexing and dispersion and all the other fun things about that, but in general, we find that active equity managers underperform the index for a variety of reasons. Has your research, you know, shown that active bond managers tend to beat the index? Because I remember at previous firm I was at, that was the case. And the reason why would be that the average bond might be 5 years. So you get to rotate that bond every 5 years. And when you buy the bond, you buy it at issue at a discount, but it doesn't go into the index until the next day when it's popped back up. So you're basically constantly every 5 years harvesting this new issue discount.
You're picking up a couple of points there, but the bigger issue, and this is part of a Substack I just wrote on these dynamics, right? Is that the index replicators, the index providers themselves actually have to select within the universe. They have to make very active choices.
But they can't buy a new issue, though.
They can't buy a new issue, so they can't benefit.
They never capture the discount. There's usually a significant discount to a new issue, especially a large one.
But they also have an allocation mechanism that then has to weight in proportion effectively to the size of the issuer, right? So bonds are issued and they're weighting them on a market cap weighted basis. Perversely, that means that when a bond goes up in price, just like we see within the equity issue, the equity markets, it gets higher weights within the marginal allocation within the bond portfolio. You can at least make a rational case for that within equity markets, right?
No, because when you issue an equity and you earn that discount, you get that once and that's it. It never comes to market again. Bond is rotating every 5 years. So you get to capture that over and over again. So and I was curious if your research actually showed that or not.
But I think within the, especially if it's an ETF, because of how they do creation and redemption of corporate bond baskets, you get differences in the underlying ETF versus the index in ways that you typically don't see in equities. I think with equity ETFs, you're going to see almost a perfect match to the underlying index exposure. So that gives some flexibility to different parties, right? Yeah. I mean, you have different players involved in the ETF creation, and there can be different reasons why you'd have some tracking error. I think I haven't done research on active corporate bonds, so I'd have a little bit less to say on that. But I mean, one thing that I've seen is, and I think this was research published by AQR a few years ago, was that some of the outperformance, or a lot of the outperformance, is really just by changing the risk profile of what they're allocating to. It's not really about cross-sectional bond selection, but taking something that's just a little bit higher yield.
It's a really interesting question. It's a really interesting question, though, that Harley's asking, which is, if you actually were to disaggregate that further, how much of the excess return for the active bond manager, which the evidence is very clear, there's alpha being added in the active bond management space.
Which is not given in equity.
Which the opposite appears to be true in equity, although I think that there are interesting dynamics around why that's occurring. But your question, Harley, is actually really interesting. I actually am working on a paper looking at the dynamics of passive fixed income, and so I'm going to actually evaluate that. That's actually super interesting and helpful to think about disaggregating it further to the new issue source of return. I don't know the answer to that, and it sounds like
you haven't done it either. I mean, you're generally pretty interested in flows and the impact flows have on markets, and I think that's something that plays a role, especially with like fallen angels. I mean, you talked about the universe, and they have strict requirements about maintaining the credit rating or corporate bonds with the appropriate credit rating for the underlying.
Well, you get to keep your cash. Every active investor has to have cash to handle redemptions. That cash can stay in bonds in a bond fund, so it's like for like. Whereas in equities, there's always this drag because they have their cash in cash, which is not an equity. So therefore, there's always a constant drag for active managers to the extent they have some money lying around the house to for redemptions.
It could theoretically work in both directions, but yes, that tends to be the case. That there is, and we've actually seen active managers take down their cash allocations. We've talked about these dynamics ad nauseum. But it is. I love that question, Harley. I'm going to actually do some research on that now. You got me actually thinking about
it. My head's spinning now.
My head is definitely spinning in a direction I hadn't anticipated. All right. So let's talk, though, about some of the work that you've done, because you're building these portfolios. And this is, by the way, one of the things I emphasize for people is that I think that one of the things that has been neglected, right? We all talk about picking stocks or picking bonds. But you actually, most of your work has been around the idea of portfolio construction and how you can actually add value through portfolio construction. Today, sitting here, it's May 25th of 2023, the answer is, do the portfolios you construct contain NVIDIA? But we were actually talking off camera about, you have a very different perspective than I think many do, which is thinking that the solution for active managers is to effectively try to become more and more alpha adding by isolating down to smaller portfolios. 35 names theoretically provide similar diversification benefits to the S&P 500. That's what we're supposed to hear from correlation dynamics. And yet you've written two papers, second one hasn't been published yet, that challenge that. Can you talk just a little bit about what your paper on diversification highlights and why it may be different than what most people think?
Yeah, and this was a paper co-authored with a colleague, Yin Chen, great work on his part. And let me speak a little bit to the motivation. I mean, I think if I go back a few years and when I was more in the institutional space, the question of, especially amongst quant, asset managers, does it make sense to hold 25 or 35 names? I mean, it rarely comes up. Most people hold, significantly more diversified portfolios. But when you're in the retail space and you work with advisors and you're onboarding clients, it's actually pretty common to see highly concentrated portfolios that are being onboarded. Very common, surprisingly so. And when you start to dig into it and, do some Google searches and seeing like what people are hearing and what they're being told, as you said, there's this thread of research that goes back decades. And I think a lot of people are essentially referencing the same. I think it all comes back to the same paper.
Yeah,
exactly. Which says, and it's a very simple model, and it's kind of an intuitive model, but sometimes intuitive models get it wrong. They say, every model is wrong, but some are useful. Yeah. But if it gives you the wrong answer, I guess you can question that. But the basic idea is that every stock has some amount of systematic risk. Every stock has some amount of non-systematic, idiosyncratic risk. Exactly. And the idiosyncratic risk diversifies very quickly. It doesn't take many names to have the idiosyncratic risk shrink. And then when you think about the total volatility of the portfolio, so you square systematic vol, square idiosyncratic vol, square rooted, sorry for the math, but if you get to the total vol of the portfolio, it quickly collapses to the vol of the market portfolio. And everybody looks at that graph, and you look at the graph and you draw the conclusion 25 to 35 names should be sufficient. And that concept just never sat well with us. It just didn't actually seem very intuitive to us. And the reason is it sort of assumes that all these stocks are very similar in structure to each other. They have the same volatility, they have the same correlation to each other, they have the same expected return. And basically, you're agnostic to which stocks you get, just so long as you get a small handful, you can diversify the idiosyncratic risk. But they don't have symmetric properties. And there is considerable kind of variation or dispersion in the properties of a portfolio when you're just selecting stocks at random. So what we did is, instead of asking the question, what is the volatility of the portfolio, which I think is intended to be a proxy for the risk to outcome, we went straight to the outcome. And the question is, if you're a long-term investor and you invest in these portfolios for 25 years and you randomly select portfolios, 25 names, 50 names, so on and so forth, what is the dispersion in terminal wealth? Because I think that's what you care about. If you get unlucky, are you going to come up short in your final wealth 25 years later versus what you could have had, if you were more diverse?
And so just to lay this out very quickly, there's two separate components that you're looking at here effectively. One is you highlight this dynamic of focusing on the outcome. So effectively, you're running a Monte Carlo type simulation and saying, if we run portfolios with 35 names, classic diversification, if we run portfolios with 100 names, if we run them with 200 names, et cetera, at what level of diversification do we begin to see the portfolio effectively reflect the asset class? So you can still have adverse outcomes because stocks suck,
right?
But what you don't want to have is an idiosyncratic risk that says you're a loser because you happen to pick the wrong 35 stocks, right?
Exactly, okay. Exactly. And we define kind of an unlucky outcome as a 10th percentile or 25th percentile outcome. And what was striking to us was, if you consider the unlucky investor who invest in 25 names, consistent with the recommendations, and compare that investor to the unlucky investor who picked 250 names at random. The unlucky investor who picked 250 names at random had 40% more end wealth 25 years later than the 25 name investor. And I look at that, and it's hard for me to say 25 names is sufficient. And if you look at the curve, it does take a couple hundred names before it starts to, you know, to plateau or level out.
You know, I can ask about this over here. So I was at UChicago shortly after, I think it was Fama published the paper saying 30 stocks is all you need to do. And I suppose that's the paper you're pushing back on, that concept of 30 stocks ain't enough. And you're saying now that you need many, many, many more to do that, which sounds to me like, you know, a core principle of why you do index investing. I'm surprised Mike hasn't jumped off his seat to grab him by the neck yet, because Mike doesn't like index investing or passive investing, which is the same thing as far as I'm concerned. So like, I'm kind of confused here, where you don't believe in passive index, whereas you seem to be saying, if you don't have 200 stocks, man, you're like out to lunch.
Well, I mean, I think there are multiple solutions to having the diversified portfolio. So, I mean, the passive index, which is cap weighted, is one solution. And it does solve, you know, the problem that I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
But there are other solutions, too. It's just the question is, how many names do you need? If the goal is diversification, you know, if somebody's goal is outperformance, if they're active and they are able to generate a true view, a true forecast of expected returns, then concentration can make sense. But the argument for the 25 to 35 name portfolio is typically not one about what's the optimal number of names if you have strong alpha. You know, the argument is, what is the optimal number of names if the goal is diversification?
It's a risk minimization and cost minimization component. You don't want to run 500 stocks in a, you know, separate account, because it's difficult to manage those 500 stocks unless you call it the S&P 500, right? So that part of it, I actually totally agree with Roni, and he's asking a very, very different question than the original FAMA paper, right? So the original FAMA paper, and this actually overlaps with some of the other stuff that we talk about, you know, my fascination with Ole Peter's work on ergodic versus non-ergodic systems, what you're effectively capturing in your paper is that same underlying phenomenon, because it's a multiplicative process. It's a time series as compared to an ensemble average, which is what the FAMA French framework is built around. So if you build it in a FAMA French framework, and exactly as Roni said, each stock has the same or roughly the same characteristics and distribution of potential outcomes, and it's largely normal in its individual construction, it's like 1,000 people investing at the same time, or 1,000 people rolling dice at the same time, you're going to get the same distribution if one person rolls a dice 1,000 times, right? But because they don't have those characteristics, what Roni's effectively saying is, you as an individual only get to follow one of the investment paths, not the giant Monte Carlo simulation that has all of them in it. And therefore, this has a much bigger impact than FAMA's theories would suggest.
The idea of having 30 stocks is you're massively reducing transaction costs and tax limits and everything else. At what point does owning 200 stocks or 150 or 250, at what point is it just better to go and just buy SPY and call it a day?
Well, I think it
the transaction cost of 200 stocks has got monumental, isn't it?
Not anymore. I mean, that the world has changed. So I think the solution...
Not for Harley, by the way.
Yeah, well, but I think the solution...
If the transaction costs were zero, Sidla wouldn't be a billionaire, okay? So clearly there's something going on here.
Well, there's a trading cost. Well, but the question is, how much turnover are you doing? I mean, if you're buying, let's call it a passive version of this and not an active version, right? So you buy 100 names, hold it for 20 years. I mean, those transactions cost are nothing amortized. You know, they're just not consequential. But, you know, I think the solution many years ago was first mutual funds, then ETFs, right? So you get a commingled vehicle and, you know, the vehicle is able to reduce the trading cost for any end investor. But I think, you know, times have changed. I mean, now commissions, they're not zero, but they're approaching zero. They're getting very small. Technology makes it very easy, relatively speaking, to implement these individual portfolios and separately managed accounts. So I think if people want customized equity portfolios, it's much more possible to do that today. And there are other benefits. It's not necessarily just alpha. I mean, if people are looking for factor exposure, if they want a momentum or low volatility portfolio, if they want it to reflect their values, so if they want to have, you know, custom socially responsible investing, they can incorporate that. But another thing that I found, and this is important for taxable accounts, is that if you're a tax loss harvester, the ability to harvest losses is significantly improved by holding a basket of individual stocks versus an ETF, because you get the dispersion of names. You can have an ETF that's up 5%, you know, in a month or in a quarter, and there's no harvesting opportunity in the ETF. And meanwhile, you can have 40% of the constituents that are down and present harvesting opportunities. So for those who are interested in tax loss harvesting, even if the goal is not to take a factor bet, as part of the portfolio, there are benefits to going to individual names.
Yeah, I mean, just very quickly, I think that there's a couple of different components that are coming through here, Harley. And to go directly to your question of why I'm not like coming through the windshield at Roni on this stuff, is actually I'm fully aware of the benefits of passive investing in a lot of these fronts. And one of the reasons why you actually are seeing these portfolios outperform over time is exactly what Roni is saying. They tend to reduce the impact, the idiosyncratic weight of any particular set of stocks by virtue of having a whole bunch of stocks in them. Now, unfortunately, one of the byproducts of passive actually leads in the opposite direction. We're seeing that in the indices where they're becoming increasingly concentrated in fewer and fewer names that actually matter. So the indices are losing some of their diversification benefits relative to the portfolios that Roni is discussing managing, for example. You'd be much closer to an equal weight S&P as compared to the S&P itself, for example, would be a typical implementation.
Yeah, there are two reasons to go in that direction. So one is it does enable you, well, three reasons. I mean, one, you have less concentration risk on individual names. Two, it enables you to express a factor exposure more strongly than you could otherwise because you have more active weight to go around. And three, it improves the tax loss harvesting opportunities as well because you're spreading out the dollars across a larger set of names.
But in no way would any of those components, for example, on a year-to-date basis for 2023, a portfolio that was equal weighted would be underperforming the S&P 500 by a fairly wide margin. You're not solving for that part of it. You're solving for a very different problem, which is equities as an asset class are expected to return something along these lines.
Right.
If I want to manage for equities as an asset class within a portfolio allocation framework, I have to run a much more diversified portfolio than otherwise. Again, you're not trying to isolate to high Sharpe selection or anything else. You're not saying we're the best stock pickers. You're saying, look, let's actually just make sure that we're managing portfolios in a way that is sensible to allow our investors to achieve their objectives over time.
And yes. Let me be clear. I'm not trying to cast dispersions on your business. I'm sure the people who invest with you will come out very well. And I think both of you guys can be right also. I don't think it's one or the other. I'm just trying to go kind of noodle on into the where is the where the rubber meets the road between those two ideas of passive and selection, which kind of leads to one more concept, which you might could dig into also. The whole business of dispersion trading, which I think kind of links into what you're talking about. How does that, you know, work with you?
Wait, when you say dispersion,
dispersion traders are guys who will buy a bunch of single name stocks and then sell the SPOOs options, and they'll run that. The idea is they're trying to bet for against correlation. And they're guys who their entire careers is just trading dispersion. It sounds like what you're doing is somewhere in between that. Is that right, Mike? Or?
I think of just the dispersion trade that you're talking about as more of an options position. But, and we're not, in this case, we're just talking about the underlying.
There are overlaps. But so just very quickly, the for the audience that's watching, the dispersion trades that Harley's referring to are actually designed to to capture the difference between a basket of options and the option on that basket, right? Effectively, they are two very different components. You are correct that one of the reasons that causes dispersion to outperform in periods like the late 1990s are primarily components of the diversification, the idiosyncratic behavior of individual names doing things like NVIDIA, right? So we saw an awful lot of that in the late 1990s where individual names within the S&P had very low observed correlation with the S&P itself. You had periods of tremendous outperformance where if I owned a call option on Cisco versus a call option on the S&P, which is an aggregation of those components, I'm gonna make much more money being long that call option on Cisco, right? So the dispersion benefits really work there. One of the reasons we've seen those strategies falter and struggle is because broadly we've seen correlations rise within the S&P and the concentration that's emerged within the S&P or many of these indices reduces some of the value of those types of characteristics as well, right? The last thing I would just say, please.
I was just going to say, I mean, although the dispersion phenomenon we're talking about right now doesn't really enter into how we think about our equity portfolios, it does enter into the discussion we had earlier on corporate bonds, because when you think about a basket of corporate bonds, the corporate bonds are essentially selling options on the single name securities, right? On the underlying constituent. Where if you look at the risk premium, the volatility risk premium tends to be heightened in index options versus single name options, hence the dispersion trade itself, right? You sell S&P and buy the basket of single names. So you actually do essentially by moving from a basket of corporate bonds to a portfolio that's getting its exposure by selling S&P vol, essentially you effectively have a dispersion exposure relative to the corporate bond index.
Yes.
So in that way, the trade does actually
On the fixed income side, that's interesting. And I would think that's right. Now, the paper that you wrote on diversification benefits, one of the critiques that people came back to, and this is similar to the discussion that people often have around the S&P 500 equal weight versus the S&P cap weighted, which is very heavily weighted to technology at this point, for example. So you wrote an extension of your paper that's not yet been published that actually looks at this issue of industry concentration. If you took the same analysis that you were doing, if I took that 35 stock portfolio and I normalized it across industry exposures, does that change the outcomes in your analysis?
So it does and it doesn't. And I think I think in this case it's important to be precise about what occurs. And just to back up, you're exactly right about the criticism. So in the original paper, essentially we were just randomly selecting stocks in the most naive way you could imagine, just plucking 25 stocks at random with no consideration to industry or sector. And one of the criticisms was few people would do that. You know, people understand that there's sector risk.
But the monkeys with darts would. So
exactly. And in fact, if you look at a lot of the articles that are written that are recommending a portfolio of 25 or 35 stocks, they will say and be very careful to select a couple stocks for every sector, you know, within each sector, so that you diversify, giving the impression that if you do that, a 25 or 35 stock portfolio is sufficiently diversified. And it's kind of a funny thing, but you have to kind of wrap your mind around the idea that sector risk is a thing. Of course, if you look at a Barra risk model or any of these risk models, or if you build one yourself, I mean, you will absolutely see that there is sector factor exposures. But idiosyncratic risk is much larger, much more important than sector risk. And if you have a small portfolio, 25 or 35 stocks, it's still dominated by idiosyncratic risk. I mean, the sector risk is there, but idiosyncratic risk is playing a bigger role. So when I said it's important to be precise about it, it's true that if you sector stratify the portfolio, you reduce the risk profile relative to non-sector stratified portfolios. It's a small change, but it does not change the conclusion on how many names do you need to have. A 250 name sector stratified portfolio has materially less dispersed outcomes than a 25 name sector stratified portfolio. So sector stratification will reduce risk a little bit. It does not mean you can have a concentrated portfolio if the goal is to reduce the magnitude of bad luck in outcomes.
So now I want to ask you, I want to extend this just a little bit more. So when we talk about the idiosyncratic risk, every time we use the phrase risk, people immediately gravitate to the left tail. Are the poor outcomes a function so much of capturing idiosyncratic downside risk, which in equity portfolios actually ironically tend to become very small very quickly, right? You can only lose 100% of any one individual weighted name. So in a 250 stock portfolio, assuming something that looks like individual weighting, I can lose 4 basis points, basically 40 basis points in any individual name, right? So it can't be that big of a downside risk. Is the risk on the other side? Is it actually the right tail risk that you're experiencing that on? So is it missing NVIDIA, for example?
Well, I mean, so I think it's that type of thing that will play a role. But when we looked at the outcomes, it's not that the 25 name portfolio lost a ton of money in 25 years. It made a lot of money. I mean, it was up considerably. It was, it's just that the 250 name portfolio that was unlucky was up 40% more, right? So essentially it's more of like an opportunity cost. You're giving up a lot of potential return. And that return does come from, the right tail outcomes. I mean, that's the thing. When you have some stocks that are compounding at 15, 20% a year over 20 years, I mean, they have an enormous impact on the total return of your portfolio. If you're missing those stocks, you're likely to still grow, but you're not going to grow as much as you could have otherwise.
Yeah, it's. I mean, that's actually exactly why I was hitting on that point, because the work that I've done on this, this is like the classic analysis of, you know, well, if you miss the 10 worst days in the market, you know, you'd be down, you know, you'd have outperformed by this much. But if you miss the 10 best days in the market, it'd be even worse, right? And therefore, you know, you never want to actually market time. This is actually very similar. It's you're effectively dealing with the issue of stock selection, saying like, hey, listen, it's great to be a hardcore value investor. You may add a ton of value in the form of alpha by selecting stocks on that basis. You're not disputing that. But what you are saying is, if you are not the world's greatest stock picker, you know, the risk that you've missed the Nvidia, that you've missed the Apple, that you've missed the Microsoft in a 25 stock portfolio as compared to a 250 stock portfolio is so elevated as to make it just a terrible idea.
Yeah, correct. I mean, and these random portfolios, there's no intent to bring on any factor exposure. I mean, of course, if you're randomly equally weighting portfolios, you're gonna have a size, right. You know, I mean, some of these are gonna come in, and if it's a small name portfolio, you know, you're gonna have random factor exposures, but it's not trying to
it's target. Not attempting to tilt.
It's not attempting to, it's just, it's stochastic.
But that, so now, and we're actually running out of time, but to go back to Harley's question in terms of like, how does this interact with my stuff on passive, right? That would almost be a perfect articulation of it, because if I'm really thinking about the career risk that exists, not so much from the client perspective, but from the portfolio manager perspective, under this type of framework, I might choose to equally weight everything in the portfolio, but I have to own the top 10 names in the S&P. Because if I don't have exposures to those, the risk becomes just too large in my portfolio, right? Which of course then creates a flow characteristic into those largest names that magnifies this. And by the way, that's part of what I'm hearing is happening in 2023, that basically people are saying, I just can't not be involved in those names.
Right, and without getting too deep in the weeds of how we actually construct the portfolios, they're very much philosophically in line with what you just mentioned, that that we do give consideration to market cap. You know, even if it's a factor-oriented portfolio, we are trying to diversify it more, but the odds of having no Apple, you know, or, you know, pick any large market cap name is, you know, very low.
It's actually it's actually a really interesting way to think about it, because effectively, if you were doing it, I don't know that you do this at all this way, but I mean, I'm just my brain is now popping, right? If I were to think about it as each basis point of potential market cap in the S&P in total represents a marble, right? And I take, you know, so Microsoft has, you know, 6,700 marbles, for example, right?
Yeah.
And you drop them into the thing and you pull them out and you basically equally weight on the basis of the random extraction there, I'm still gonna overweight Microsoft if I end up doing that, because it simply has more lottery tickets or balls in the mix sort of thing, even though I'll almost never end up at the actual market cap weights.
Right, and we don't do that, but that is an interesting.
Yeah, it never occurred to me. That would be a fun randomization exercise to see what the impact of doing that.
I don't want you to give away the secret sauce, but if you're picking that many companies, then clearly the factors you choose or the sectors you choose must be more important to go and do it. How do you go and do that?
Yeah, so we focused
on very broad terms without revealing your secrets.
Well, I mean, the two things I would say is, I mean, so we have a view on what we think best practice is, and we focus on, you know, the large, well-established styles or factors. I mean, however you decide to call it, but it's value, momentum, quality, low volatility, and effectively size by doing it, you know, closer to an equal weight tilt. So we enable those five factors. For those who are interested, they can turn them all on. But it's, like I said, it's a very personalized portfolio. So if someone only wants momentum and value, they can just select those two and turn off the other three, or they can essentially select, you know, any combination thereof. They can select socially responsible investing preferences. So we've licensed data from As You Sow, which is a large nonprofit, and they categorize stocks according to a bunch of different criteria, which allows people to kind of pick and choose different themes that they want to exclude, and they can override that. So it's a pretty sophisticated portfolio construction, where we really allow every individual portfolio to be built kind of bottom up, right? They're all individually constructed based off of those preferences.
And over the last decade, which has been the favored factor or sector, and going forward, if you had to go pick one or two, what would you say?
Enter the factor timing debate.
I will not. Yeah. So, I mean, I, I try to stay out of the factor timing. I think there has been some evidence of factor momentum. I mean, like, factor momentum. So, you know, if you were to time on momentum, I mean, there's also some evidence on timing on potentially on some of the spreads. We don't incorporate factor timing into what we do. But if I were to use the factor timing, you know, lens, then it tends to not be like the past 10 years that I think is predictive. It's more like the momentum horizon. So, you know, value would probably do okay right now. I mean, it's had a rough 10 years, but a decent, you know,
decent 2 months. Yeah.
Yeah. but we don't really incorporate factor timing into what we do.
Interesting. Okay. So, quick takeaway that I would withdraw from, you know, that I would try to take away from what you're trying to accomplish at Endeavor is, one, you're continuing to allow actively managed portfolios. One of the dynamics in your approach, though, is to emphasize for people that you have to run much more diversified portfolios, or you're introducing a truly random factor, which is basically called the I didn't choose, right? I did not get Apple in my portfolio, therefore I'm underperforming, not because of anything else, but because idiosyncratically that got left out. Now, that's an overstatement of it, but you're saying that component of risk that your idiosyncratically actively managed portfolio does not at all match the asset class expectation,
right,
becomes a critical factor that many people are underappreciating in their portfolio construction.
Definitely underappreciated. I think with technology, it's not hard to, you know, to fix that. And there's no reason to take uncompensated risk. So if you can mitigate that uncompensated risk, you might as well do it.
I absolutely love that answer to it. So that is absolutely the right way to think about it. If you can get compensated for risk, you should take it. If you cannot get compensated for it, don't take it.
Exactly.
And that is really, again, coming back full circle, that is part of the reason why it has been so frustrating for active managers, is this is yet another example of everybody knows, right? If you're going to be an active manager, you're going to do better by picking a concentrated portfolio. Part of what Roni's work is actually pointing out is that may not be true, actually. And so ironically, it would suggest that part of, again, just like the story that the problem with active management is that there's too many active managers and not enough people invested in passive. My work says that's 180 reversed, right? Roni's work would say the diversification advice that is often being given to active managers exposes both their clients to idiosyncratic risk and candidly exposes them to firm and career risk for exactly the same reasons.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's observable, I mean, if people, you know, maybe don't find my, you know, our conclusions intuitive, but I mean, just think about the dispersion and performance of concentrated active managers, right? They are clearly not substitutes for each other. So you can just look at, you know, active management and equities, and I think it tells the same story.
Well, and it also, that of course then raises the dynamic of the role of luck. Again, this is a component of the Ole Peters work, right? Those active managers running 35 stock portfolios that are overly concentrated in your analysis that happen to have a lucky streak then get to become the potentates that show up on TV and say, hey, you should invest in my fund because clearly I'm a genius. And what you're saying is no, this is yet another example of there have to be some lucky outliers in those sorts of portfolios.
Definitely.
Yeah, fascinating. All right, Roni, this was absolutely awesome, as always. I love sitting down and talking with you. My brain is now spinning with stuff that you've introduced, that Harley's introduced. That's why I do these things.
Excellent.
So I'm going to dash away and immediately go sit down on my laptop and start working on stuff. But Roni, thank you again. If people want to get in touch with you at Endeavor or with your advisors, how would you recommend that?
Yeah, they can go to ndvr.com or they can email me, roni.israelov@ndvr.com.
All right, fantastic. And are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter.
Are you active on Twitter?
I need to be more active on
you
Twitter.
You do not need to be more active on Twitter. But if people wanted to find your Twitter account, what would it be?
It is Roni Israelov.
Roni Israelov, and that's I-S-R-A-E-L-O-V, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, I-S-R-A-E-L-O-V.
Okay. Perfect. Fantastic. Roni, thank you so much. Harley, as always, it's great being here with you.
Simplify Asset Management, Inc. is a registered investment advisor. Advisory services are only offered to clients or prospective clients where Simplify Asset Management, Inc. and its representatives are properly licensed or exempt from licensure. SEC registration does not constitute an endorsement of the firm by the Commission, nor does it indicate that the advisor has attained a particular level of skill or ability. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and/or tax professional before implementing any strategy. This website and information are not intended to provide investment, tax, or legal advice. This content is solely for informational purposes and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. These materials are made available on an as-is basis without representation or warranty. The information contained in these materials has been obtained from sources that Simplify Asset Management, Inc. believes to be reliable, but accuracy and completeness are not guaranteed. This information is only current as of the date indicated and may be superseded by subsequent market events or for other reasons. Neither the author nor Simplify Asset Management, Inc. undertakes to advise you of any changes in the views expressed herein. Past performance is no guarantee of future returns. Investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Unless otherwise noted, any performance returns presented in these materials reflect hypothetical performance. Hypothetical strategies and indices presented are unmanaged, do not reflect any fees, expenses, transaction costs, commissions, or taxes, and one cannot invest directly in any of these. The results presented should not be viewed as indicative of the advisor's skill and do not reflect the performance results that were achieved by any particular client. During this period, the advisor was not providing advice using this model, and clients' results may have been materially different. Hypothetical model results have many inherent limitations, some of which, but not all, are described herein. One of the limitations of hypothetical performance results is that they are generally prepared with the benefit of hindsight. In addition, hypothetical trading does not involve financial risk, and no hypothetical trading record can completely account for the impact of financial risk in actual trading.